Are you ready to transform your financial future through mortgage note investing? Hi, I'm Jamie Bateman, host of the From Adversity to Abundance podcast. As a passionate entrepreneur myself and real estate investor myself, I've dedicated my career to empowering investors like you. Join my mentorship program tailored to meet your unique business objectives with a very small financial commitment to get started. Gain access to my personal experience, trusted consultants and vendors, and receive customized mentoring services. You'll get hands-on guidance on everything from determining your buy box and reviewing your bidding processes to managing notes with third-party servicers, handling collateral, and much more. Don't wait. Visit LabradorLending.com to start your journey to abundance today. Let's unlock your full potential together. This episode is truly a special one. It's a republishing of episode number one of the From Adversity to Abundance podcast, and it's with Mark Owens. Mark's story truly was the impetus behind my starting of this podcast. I had interviewed him previously on a different podcast, and his story just blew me away. It's incredible. He has overcome so much, and he actually ended up writing the foreword to my book, which is called From Adversity to Abundance, Inspiring Stories of Mental, Physical, and Financial Transformation that you can purchase on Amazon. Mark grew up in Baltimore in poverty, didn't have a great upbringing as far as, you know, family and stability, got into drugs, got into theft and robbery and bank robberies, and went to prison, was homeless, and turned his life around. Just an amazing story of overcoming adversity. He turned to real estate investing, got into multifamily and residential real estate investing in Baltimore. And I mean, he is an incredible storyteller and just an incredible inspiration to those who maybe have had gotten the raw end of a deal, but also have created a lot of their own adversity. And, you know, this one is just amazing. I can't say enough about this episode. Mark is such an inspiration and retired himself and his wife. They travel around. She is a traveling nurse still, I believe, but they are absolutely living it up now, traveling, doing whatever they want, working on their own schedule. And it's just amazing what he's overcome. You're not going to want to miss this episode. We do talk some about real estate investing and more the practical side of running a real estate investing business, but it's truly more about inspiration and overcoming incredible hardship. There's something for everyone in this episode.
Welcome to From Adversity to Abundance, the go-to podcast for real estate entrepreneurs seeking not just to thrive, but to conquer with resilience and mental sharpness. Each week, join us as we dive into the compelling world of real estate through the lens of mental fitness, where challenges transform into opportunities. Get ready to transform your mindset and expand your understanding of what it takes to succeed in real estate. Let's explore these stories of triumph and resilience together.
Welcome, everybody, to our first episode of the From Adversity to Abundance podcast. I am your host, Jamie Bateman. I'm really excited about launching this podcast, and I'm really excited about our guest today as well. So our guest is Mark Owens. Excuse me. Mark, how are you doing today?
Awesome, Jamie. Thank you.
Yeah, Mark, we had Mark on the Good Deeds show. I think it was late December. About 3 months ago. And I'm not kidding when I say, Mark, your episode really inspired me enough so that I am actually launching this podcast. I would say largely because of that episode and episodes similar to it. You know, we didn't dive into real estate too much, you know, but it was more of a mindset and, you know, overcoming adversity type episode. And it really did inspire me to kind of think bigger and launch this podcast. So I'm really excited. But this episode is not about me. It's about you. So for our listeners, Mark, if you could, it's about you and our listeners, but if you could, why don't you tell us your current situation and then we'll jump back to your backstory.
Sure. Yeah. Just the first thing I want to say is that I really, really am honored and appreciate the fact that you invited me on, and it means a lot to me. It truly does, because that's what I feel like my purpose is at this stage in my life, is to inspire other people and show them what's possible and help them to develop a life of their dreams, whatever their dreams are. And so I really appreciate the opportunity to help.
Absolutely.
Positively influence people. So
yeah, I love it.
As far as where I'm at today, I am 56, about to turn 57 years old, married for 5 years. My wife has trouble keeping track too. So
it's not just you.
Let me see. I've been a full-time real estate investor for close to 20 years. Got a son. He's doing amazing. He's in his early 20s. He's living in Charlotte, North Carolina, is working in an investment bank. My wife is now a travel nurse, so we're traveling around the country. She does a 3-month gig at one place and then a 3-month gig somewhere else. We're currently in Charleston, South Carolina, which is where I am right now.
But the weather's a little nicer. You're from Baltimore. I'm from the Baltimore area as well. I just got a notification on my phone about the snow coming in today, and it's March 30th. So imagine the weather's a little nicer down there.
I think it's going to be like 76 today.
Nice.
Sorry.
That's awesome. No, it's all good.
Yeah. So, so that's what we're doing now. I just want to back up just to the beginning of the real estate stuff. Like, I started buying rentals, 2002, I bought my first one. This time last year, I had a little over 100 units. And then I started, downsizing. The market was doing really well. And I had a lot of interest from out of town investors that were cash buyers without paying real estate commissions. So it was literally saved me hundreds of thousands of dollars in real estate commissions just by doing these direct sales to people at what I consider retail prices. Mm-hmm. So I ended up scaling down. I've got about 30 units now.
Okay.
31, somewhere in that range.
Yeah.
And I don't have any debt except for my Visa, which I use for everything just so I can track my spending
expenses. Sure.
And then I pay that off every month. And I spend a lot of my time just, trying to find stuff to do. Like, I'm trying to learn photography. I try to learn Spanish for a while, but no comprende. I'm just terrible at it.
Not happening.
And I'm just like spending my time trying to find things to do. I started doing some coaching, but that's very limited. I'm only taking a few people at a time and all that, because if it starts to feel like a job, and I'm not going to want to do it. If I don't want to do it, I'm not going to give 100%. And if I don't give 100%, I'm going to feel like shit, because I'm going to feel like I'm ripping somebody off. So it's like, I don't want to, I'm not trying to have like a volume of 50 people a month sign up. It's like just a couple a month.
And so at the height of your real estate, kind of investing, what did that look like?
I self-managed my units, which a lot of people they're just they just can't believe it. And they're like, how do you do it? But I mean, I'm telling you, I built up a bunch of systems and processes where I managed it. And at the height of my unit count, it's probably 107 units.
Those were multifamily or I'm just curious.
Single family and multis combination.
Okay. Got it.
I could say I have one building, but the one building has 18 apartments. So I would say that's 18 units.
And these were all in Baltimore City?
Everything in Baltimore City.
Got it.
And at the peak, I wasn't working any more than 2 or 3 hours a day. And the way that I was able to do that was that I just figured out, when something happened that I had to do and I didn't like it, I tried to figure out a way to get somebody else to do it, either automate it or get something. So the easiest example is a tenant calls up and maybe they complain that the stove isn't working. Well, I could get stuck in this phone call loop where I tell a tenant, okay, let me call you back. And then I call the appliance repair company and they say, okay, Tuesday at noon. All right, let me call you back. And then I call the tenant back and she says she can't do Tuesday. She can do Thursday. And you get stuck in that.
Sure. Yep.
Well, it's happened, so many times. And I just said, listen, I'm just going to give the damn tenant the number to the repair company and she can call. And I'm out of it. I'm out of it. I'm out of 17 phone calls just by giving her the number. Yeah. I did the same thing with, you know, with the plumber, the electrician, the furnace guy, the exterminator. It's like, just give the tenant, empower the tenant to call. I'm paying for it, so it's not going to cost them anything. And then they can find a time that works good for them.
Yeah.
And I just built my whole business around that. And
that's great. I've seen some of your YouTube videos and things, and it just comes across that your tenants were, and I've heard you on other podcasts as well, but your tenants, it seems like you had a good relationship with your tenants. You guys were on the same team. It wasn't an adversarial relationship. Is that fair to say?
I would say that is true the majority of the time. I mean, I try to work with my tenants as customers, not as adversaries. Mm-hmm. And a lot of landlords look at it's like me against a tenant. I'm just like, yeah, these are my customers. I want happy customers. I want my tenant to live in this house for 20 years. I want them to pay the rent on time. But even if they're late now and then, like, vacancies kill you, turnovers kill you. I want them to stay there, forever. I want their grandchildren to grow up in that house. Yeah. And part of the way that you do that is just treat them with the same respect that you treat your accountant or your attorney.
That's what I do.
I treat everybody the same. I don't care if it's a Section 8 mom with four kids from four different fathers, or, you know, my title attorney or my accountant or my bookkeeper. I treat them all with the same amount of respect. And I think that goes a long way.
That's actually a really good, probably a good segue into your backstory, I think, because, I mean, you know, I try to do that as well. Right. And sounds good. but it's sometimes easier said than done. I mean, but I think that your backstory in particular, you've been through, you've seen, you know, we'll get into that, but you've seen a lot of different things, and you've kind of lived at different maybe levels as far as financial success. And you've experienced a lot of hardship and been exposed to a lot of different kind of segments of the population, if you will. And I think maybe I don't want to put words in your mouth, but maybe that's helped you appreciate, you know, person for a person, and they all have, everybody has value. And so with that, why don't we dive into your backstory, if you don't mind? And because when we got into this on the Good Deeds show, it really did blow me away. So I think our listeners are going to really benefit from this. So if you could dive into your backstory for us.
Okay. So I was born in 1965, Baltimore City, grew up in a blue collar, mostly white neighborhood, working class. Where I was growing up, like, the dream of like 10, 11, 12 year old boys was to get a job driving a forklift at a factory. Like, that's as far as we could see. Like, man, if you can get a job driving a forklift at Knoxell or Pepsi, like, you're set, for life. Cause then you can go buy your little row house, you know, with like two, maybe three bedrooms, have a couple of kids and, you know, one car, because back in the 70s, most families just had one car.
That's all you needed, really. Yeah.
And you could live, you know, a happy middle-class life. And that was our dream. And I had never really felt like, I just thought like, there's gotta be more than that. Mm-hmm. There's gotta be more than just driving a forklift. And, but I was too young to really visualize that. And my family structure, I was an only child. Mother had me when she was 17, quit school, worked at a factory, didn't meet my biological father until I was like 17. And he was a junkie in and out of jail. And, you know, just a bad guy. Had another stepfather for a few years, and that didn't work out. Then I got another stepfather, but him and I never really related, because he was like, he went to college. He was like nobody in my neighborhood went to college. It's like, who is this guy? You know, and so I never really felt like I fit in. And so what happened was, you know, we had drug education in school, like in elementary school, and you're sitting there and you're looking at the pictures and you're hearing the stories, and, you know, you're thinking like, oh my God, I would never do that. There's people crazy. Like, my God, why would you do that? And then I think I was like 12 years old, and one of my friends asked me if I wanted to smoke some pot. And I'm thinking like, this is a chance for me to fit in, because I never really felt like I fit in. So I did.
So I got a quick question. Was that the DARE program?
No, I don't think there was a DARE program back then. I mean, gotcha. This was like literally like 1975.
Got it. The reason I ask is I did some studies in criminal justice back in the day, really didn't end up doing anything with it. And I remember one of the things, you know, you can argue both sides to almost every type of like criminal justice policy and education and different, you know, government policies, there's pros and cons to everything. Well, I remember the DARE program in particular actually stood out as having no positive effect, and potentially a negative effect, because it exposed kids to things they wouldn't have been exposed to. That's right. A whole separate story, but that's interesting.
Yeah, in my neighborhood, it was very easy to get exposed. I was smoking pot when I was 12 years old, right. and so were all my friends. So I was 12 years old and smoking weed, smoking cigarettes, and something happened that changed my relationship with my parents forever. Hmm. You know, my mom up until that point had always told me, you know, like if I ever like smoke cigarettes or like anything like that, like just come talk to her about it. Mm-hmm. And I trusted her, and she, so I started smoking cigarettes. This was before I started smoking weed. Mm-hmm. And I went and talked to my mom. I said, "Mama, you know, I want to talk to you. You know, I smoked a couple of cigarettes and you told me if I ever did anything like that to come talk to you." Mm-hmm. And then she started screaming on me, telling me I was stupid, made me chew up a cigarette, and, completely humiliated me. And that changed our relationship up till today, where I no longer saw her as a friend or a confidant or somebody I could talk to. I saw her as the enemy because she stabbed me in the back. She told me to come talk to her, and then I come talk to her and she humiliates me. And I think that may have also been partially what led me to saying yes when I had the opportunity to smoke weed.
Got it.
Then, I started, she found that I was getting high. We ended up moving out of Baltimore City, out to Baltimore County, which was at the time a lot different than it is now. It was a lot more innocent, a lot more naive. Mm-hmm. I was a city kid coming out to the suburbs, and I felt like my classmates, even though we were the same age, I just felt like they were little kids. You know, like, on the street I grew up on, there were, I think, you know, one of my best friends' fathers was shot on the corner. A couple years later, another one of my friends, his girlfriend's mother was stabbed to death up the street from my house. I mean, it's a, and then I come out to Perry Hall, and it was almost like a Leave It to Beaver kind of neighborhood, like very, like, you know, just different.
Innocent.
And
right.
Yeah, it seemed like it to me. Mm-hmm. And so I was the bad kid. You know, I started, then my drug use started to escalate, where, you know, it was like, went from weed to drinking to, you know, all the pills and, you know, inhalants and, you know, everything I could get my hands on. I'll kind of speed through this, but, you know, I failed the 10th grade, went to a couple of years of summer school, ended up getting kicked out of high school in November of my senior year. And this, I was very defiant and resented authority and, you know, didn't want to hear like people telling me what to do. And I don't know where that came from, but it was there. And, you know, the vice principal called me into his office. And, you know, about my truancy, which was chronic. And he told me the next time I cut a class, he was going to, you know, suspend me to the Board of Education with a recommendation for expulsion. Mm-hmm. And that was like a challenge to me. So he gave me my pass to get back to class. And I walked out the front door and of the school. And then the next day I go back to school and I get suspended with a, you know, recommendation for expulsion. And I went home. I left that on my kitchen table in my house. I packed up my stuff, and then I moved down to my grandmother's house, which was back down in the city in the neighborhood that I grew up in. And I was a drug addict. You know, I was very good at manipulating people, and my mother and her mother had had some issues, so I was very good at putting a wedge there and making it look like I'm the good guy, my mother's the bad guy. So my grandmother took me in, but there was zero structure there. And I'd thought that, okay, look, I'm going to quit school and then I'm going to go get a job. I'm going to go get a job and make some money, because this stuff's a waste of my time. I mean, how many times can you learn about the same shit year after year after year? Oh, we're doing another semester on American history. We've had those semesters on American history for the last 6 years. It's like,
you can't change it. I remember not, I've gotten more into history now. I'm not super into it, but I can relate to that. I was like, well, what does it mean to me? I can't change anything about what happened.
Well, exactly. And when you're a kid, you don't understand that. You know, exactly. like now you can look back and you can see the history and you can see that how it tends to repeat, and you try to learn from it. But, you know, it's not us individually, but as our society and our politicians, just keep falling into the same traps.
I didn't care about it either.
But I just.
Sorry. Go ahead. Yeah. I think there was
so a I got out there. Of it. I got out of school. Couldn't. That's okay. It couldn't get a good job or anything like that. And but just kept doing my drug stuff. And then I was 17 years old. I remember it was February 1982. And I remember this because I actually wrote it on my calendar because I was proud of it. The first time I saw, it was a friend of mine. I saw his brother shooting coke in his bedroom. And I asked him, I was like, man, like, how much is that? And he said it was $25 for a quarter gram. I was like, well, how many shots do you get? And he said two. And I was like, man, can I get one? And I did. He said, man, he'll sell me some of his. So I did a shot of coke. Then I did the other one like 10, 15 minutes later. And that really changed things because up until that point, I had done some bad stuff. I'd stolen cars. I'd broken into some houses. I had broken into schools and stole like triple beam scales and stuff like that. But because that's what all the drug dealers, like you could trade those for drugs. It's a really easy transaction. So but that changed everything because, you know, what happens when you start to do stuff like that is you think, well, if things ever start getting bad, I'll just quit. Like I would never let it get that bad. I mean, that's what everybody that weighs 300 pounds says, well, I'll never let myself get that fat, you know? Right. And then 20 years later, there they are. And so it's the same trap, whether it's you're talking about your weight, which a lot of people in America can relate to, or the drug stuff. You say you'll never let yourself get to that point, and then you do. And it's very gradual, so you don't really notice it because it's just a little bit more, a little bit more, a little bit more. And so I started shooting coke. And then like a month later, I found out another guy that I knew was doing heroin. And I thought, man, I'd like to try that out. I like coke. Heroin's probably pretty decent too. And, you know, called him up, ended up, you know, that day or the next day, trying heroin for the first time. So, you know, by the time I turned 18, I was already shooting coke and heroin. And I'll give the short story, but over the next few years, you know, I was in and out of jails, rehabs, living in the street, you know, in abandoned houses, sleeping under bridges. You know, I got stuck in California, had a hitchhike from California to Baltimore with no money. Got kicked out of a drug rehab in Virginia, and it was winter, and it's like I violated my probation. I'm gonna get a prison for 4 years for violating my probation. So my choice is either go back to Baltimore and go to jail or go somewhere else. And my thoughts are, well, if I'm gonna live outside, I'm gonna be homeless, I'm going south. So I hitchhiked to Florida and wound up in Jacksonville, Florida, which is like literally like the home of the homeless. I mean, there are so many homeless people there. And I think that's because a lot of people hitchhike to Florida or drive there or whatever, and that's the first big city that they hit. And there's a lot of resources. If you're like living in the street, there's a lot of missions and shelters and, you know, stuff like that. So there's a lot of resources there for people that are like down and out.
Right. So there's a good thing, but it ends up drawing more homelessness.
It's good. It was good for me. I don't know if it was good for people that like live there.
Right.
But but when you're hungry, you know, and you're cold and you don't care, you know, it's like you're just looking out for your Maslow's hierarchy, you know, like I need food, shelter, clothes, you know, I worry about the self actualization.
Right. That's
30
that's
years later, tomorrow. I'm sitting in my camper in South Carolina talking to Jamie Bateman.
Right. So. No, that's just the whole, I mean, I was talking to my daughter. My daughter's 14. She's almost 15. We were talking about drugs and, you know, it's like, I don't have a ton of experience with that, you know, myself, but I haven't heard a lot of people who say, oh, I'm experimenting. Or I guess they say I'm experimenting, but it's like, well, does that ever turn out positively? And I'm not judging here. I'm just saying
it didn't for me.
Experiment with heroin, I haven't heard anyone say, oh, I'm really glad I did that. You know, in hindsight, the experiment worked out well. It's like, you know, it doesn't go well, right?
I agree with you 100%. But here's the other part that people don't want to talk about is that people usually start with weed.
Gotcha.
Yeah. And I'm not saying that weed leads to heroin, because it's not, weed doesn't do anything. Weed is just a drug. What it does is it opens us up to, well, what's the next step? It's not pot's fault, because there were a million decisions that I made as an individual between the first time I smoked weed and the first time I shot coke, you know, so I don't blame pot for this at all. It's just, I mean, this is 100% my fault. But I want to fast forward through a little bit because I want to get to the part that was, I think, the most important thing. I'm just going to fast forward to the summer of 1989 when my drug use reached like the part where I was at the point of no return. I robbed the bank in Philadelphia, outside of Philadelphia, 1989. And I was already out on bail for doing another, like a theft. I think they charged me a strong arm robbery, but it was eventually dropped to theft. I was out on bail for that. I needed money to pay my rent. My girlfriend was, really pissed off and all that again, because I fucked up again. And I just decided I'm just going to go rob a bank. That's it. So I went, I'll tell you how I used to steal cars. I'll tell you how I did it. People can figure it out on their own. But what I used to do is, and I've stolen a lot of cars. I would find an apartment building in the area of wherever I was at. And I would get the address, and then I would call a pizza delivery place. And I would say, back then they had pay phones, right? You put a, they were like a dime. It might have went up to a quarter. I put a dime in it, call the pizza place and say, hey, I want a large pepperoni pizza. I'm at 4100 Buchanan Avenue, apartment G. And then I sit across the street. 40 minutes later, the pizza guy pulls up. They always leave the engine running, always, because they're in a hurry.
Sure.
I sit across the street. See the guy get out with the pizza, run in, opens the apartment building door, starts running up the steps. I go hop in his car and take off. That's how I used to steal cars. And sometimes I get a free pizza too. I mean, it was awesome.
Bonus. Jeez. So then might sound like a dumb question, but what would you do with the car at that point?
I would use it to go rob whatever I was going to rob, whether it was drug dealer or, usually I use my own car for drug dealers because they already knew me anyway. But, for the, for the bank and for other places I was robbing, I was just stealing cars. And I would actually use them for a couple of days because there are so many of them, police aren't actually out looking for them. They find the stolen car when it's in an accident or, something like that. Or you get pulled over because you were speeding or ran a red light or something. So that's how they find them. They're not actually out looking for them, at least in a big city like Baltimore. Maybe if you're in a small town or something, they might, but big city like Baltimore, they're not. They got too much other stuff to worry about.
So 1989, you robbed this bank.
The bank. And it was the next day, my girlfriend didn't even know about it. I paid the rent, got a bunch of money hidden in the kitchen. And, nobody knows but me and a friend in Baltimore that I told. And the next morning, it was 5 o'clock in the morning, 6 o'clock in the morning, we get a knock on the door. And we're laying in there sleeping. And my girlfriend goes up and answers the door. And it was a sheriff or one of the deputies and a bail bondsman. And they were revoking my bail because apparently one of my girlfriend's friends called them up and said I was going to leave the state and abscond from justice. Bless you. So I was a drug addict. I'm very good at manipulating people. I'm very good at, sizing people up and making quick decisions on how to respond to the people.
Sure.
And that's just one of the benefits that you get from living that lifestyle. And
street smarts kind of, right? And emotion, I guess, whatever they call that, emotional, intellectual intelligence.
Yeah. Mine was on fire. And so I just thought, I'm sitting there and I'm like, okay, so they're taking me back to jail. I'm like, okay, well, I'm going to get the fuck out of this. How am I going to do it? I'm like, well, I just need to buy some time to just think about this. So I was very courteous with the guys. I was very non-confrontational, nothing okay, no problem, man. Can I get dressed? Just asking permission. And I remember I was a cocky little punk. And I remember tying my shoes and I looked at my girlfriend and I winked at her. And she didn't know what I was, she had no idea, but I'm like, man, I'm getting the fuck out of here. I'm getting dressed to run. I'm not getting dressed to go to jail. I'm putting on loose fitting clothing. I'm tying my shoes tight. I'm getting the fuck out of here. And then I didn't know how I was going to do it, but I knew I was. And we're on the top floor. It's like a row house. And we were on the top floor. It was the third floor apartment. And in the kitchen, there was a fire escape with steps that went downstairs. Yeah. And then in the hallway next between the kitchen and the bedroom, there was a stairwell that went down, through the common area.
Yeah.
And I asked the the sheriff, I said, listen, man, can I call my grandma and tell her what's going on? Because she's the one that, you know, bailed me out. And I don't want her worried about me. Do you mind if I just call her for a minute? And he said, no, no problem at all. Because I was acting very pleasant, you know, very compliant, no bullshit. And I got on the phone and I didn't even call her. I just pretended I did. And I'm just talking to like dead air. I'm just talking. And just trying to figure out what I'm going to do, because the bail bonds guy was standing by the door that goes out to the fire escape. And the sheriff was at the other door to the kitchen that led to the hallway that went down the steps. Mm-hmm. And I just kept talking and kept talking. And the sheriff asked me if I would, he said, man, you got to hang up. I was like, all right, just a sec. And they said, and he's like, man, you got to hang up now. And I said, all right, man, just a sec. And I kept talking. He came around behind me, which he shouldn't have done, because then he left me a path to the hallway. And he reached around and grabbed my hand that was on the phone.
Yeah.
I spun around and picked his ass up and threw him on the kitchen table, and then spun back around down the hallway, down the steps, out to the alley. Then I went down to, it's called the Schuylkill River, which is a fairly large river in the Philadelphia area. And I'm figuring, you know, they're going to be looking for me now.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
I just threw this deputy over the kitchen table. So they're probably going to be looking for me.
Took this to the next level. Yep.
Yeah. And then it was just, you know, I got to get the fuck out of here. So the river was too big to cross. Like I would have drowned if I had tried to cross it, but there was a bridge that went across the river. Sorry about the traffic. If you hear that. So there was a bridge that went across the river, but it was a pretty far away across. And I thought, I can't leave myself exposed by going over top the river, because it's going to be easy to spot me. Mm-hmm. So I went up and climbed up underneath the bridge where they have these girders that go across. And I kind of like just held on and just kind of wiggled my way across and got to the other side of the river. It sounds like shit on TV. There were railroad tracks, and there was a freight train going down the railroad, and he was going pretty fast, probably like, I'm going to guess 15 miles an hour, because my top speed for like 5 seconds is 15 miles an hour, like somewhere in that
room. Right.
And I was running as fast as I could. It might have been a little slower, maybe 12 miles an hour, because it was on gravel, and I was running as fast as I could trying to grab onto this train. Didn't know where it was going. Didn't care. I'm just going to hop on it. I'll hop off, whether it's, you know, the next day, 2 days later, I could be in Kansas. I don't give a shit getting out of here. But I was afraid, like I was just barely keeping up. And I thought, man, if I fall, like I might like get my arms cut off. Like, like this is like, right. This isn't working. And so I stopped chasing a train and I backtracked. There was another town on the other side of the bridge, and I can't remember what it was called. I was in Norristown. That's where I started. And I can't remember what the other town was. But I just thought, I was walking around, I'm like, man, I need a ride, you know? And I'm just thinking like, I'm going to jack somebody. I don't know what I'm going to do, but I need to get out of here. And I'm walking through this little neighborhood, and there was a car that just pulled up in front of this pharmacy, and he double parked in the street and left the motor running. And he went in the pharmacy, and I was like, there's my ride. It's like the law of attraction, right? I just attracted a car to Jack, and I went and hopped in it and took off, and I'm heading back to Baltimore. And it's a funny story. There was a kid that was hitchhiking, and I picked him up. People used to hitchhike back in the 70s and 80s. I hitchhiked like all over the place through.
Yeah. I know my father's told me stories about that.
Yeah. And, this kid's hitchhiking. I picked him up and we're driving, and I told him, man, I've hitchhiked all over the place. And he's like, yeah. And I said, yeah, but I found an easier way. Like, I don't really hitchhike anymore. And he's like, really? What do you do? And I was like, well, I steal cars. And he said, really? I was like, yeah, I just stole this one. Oh my gosh. And that would have been like, that would have been a great Instagram pic, right? The face he made.
right. Before memes were a thing.
Exactly.
Yes.
So I ended up, you know, I dropped them off a little while later. I made my way back to Baltimore. No money. I got a car. I got a bunch of money back at my apartment, but my girlfriend didn't even know about it. And wouldn't you know, the very next day, the feds raided our apartment.
Wow.
I found the money.
How old were you at this point?
I think 24. Okay. It was 1989.
Got it. Right.
Okay. And yeah, that was around August, something like that, 89. It may be the very beginning of August. And
So then, and I don't mean to step on your toes here. If we can fast forward a little bit, because I know you hit on the Good Deeds episode, we hit several other stories that were mm-hmm. critical. I remember several things where like the attorney when you were in jail, and I think
I was coming to that
cab driver. I'm sorry, yeah. But those were critical key points, and I don't want to miss those.
Sure. So what happened was at that point I'd kind of given up, and I just thought, well, I'm just gonna get high till I die. Like I'm gonna rob stores every day. Or whatever. I'll steal a different car every day, and I'll just do this until I either get shot or overdose. Like there was no, like jail was never an option. It's either I'm going to get shot or I'm going to OD. Like that's it. And I'm just going to keep, this is what I'm choosing to do. And after it was September, I think it was September 7th of 89, I decided that I was going to go out to Alaska. They had this Alaska Valdez like oil spill, and they were hiring anybody to just come out and like wipe oil off of ducks and rocks and whatever. And I'm just like, man, I'll go hide in Alaska, I'll get a job, and you know. And I thought I'll just try this, you know, stolen cars out there. And what I did, you can't do this anymore, but you could go out, fill your tank with gas and just take off. Like now you got to pay first. Back then you didn't, you know. And so I would just fill the tank and take off. And I mean, that's how I got. I stole a car in Georgia, made it to Pennsylvania, just doing just that. So it wasn't a big deal. And I mean, it's a terrible thing to do, but it was very simple to do it.
Sure.
And so I just started robbing stores like every day. You know, it wasn't a lot of money, a few hundred bucks here, a few hundred bucks there, but you know, if you're a junkie and you're broke, $300 is a lot of money. Mm-hmm. And in September 7th, I decided I'm going to go out to California and or Alaska. And I talked to a girlfriend and I just told her what I was going to do. And her and I had been friends for years, and she was, you know, kind of hardcore like I was. And I said, well, let's go hang out tonight. So I went and got a motel room out on, it's called Pulaski Highway in the Baltimore area. Mm-hmm. And went out, and that night, you know, I had some money from previous robberies and went, bought some drugs, got a hotel room, we're getting high. And then I thought, let's go rob something else. So we left the hotel or motel, went and robbed another store, went and bought some drugs, went our way back to the motel, and I ran a red light in a stolen car and ended up, to make the long story short, ended up getting caught. You know, I got boxed in. I couldn't escape. There was cars in front of me. It was like 2 o'clock in the morning, September 8th. I'm thinking like, where the fuck are all these people going? I mean, Jesus Christ, you know, like I got no space to navigate. Mm-hmm. And the car I had stolen, it was like a 280Z or something. It was really fast. It was a fast car. So I thought, if I get an opening, like, I'm out of here. and so, you know, they get us boxed in, and the cops are like jumping out with their guns out and the lights on and all this. And I asked Barb, I said, hey, Barb, give me the drugs. She gave them to me. And I'm just thinking like, look, I'm not going out like this. Like they're going to have to shoot my ass. Like I'm not just getting out and like turning myself in. So I got out and opened the door and I put my arms up and I looked around for an opening. And then I just took off running. And I mean, I remember like gritting my teeth, like just thinking like, man, if they fucking shoot me, like just keep fucking running, no matter what, just keep fucking running. Because I'm going to go to jail for the rest of my fucking life. That's what I'm thinking. And it's like, sure. I would rather bleed out in the street than spend the next 50 years in jail.
Hmm. And yeah, I mean, it sounds crazy to say, but it seems logical.
Yeah, it did. It did to me. Right. I mean, it's a tough choice. It's like, you know, do you want to die tonight or do you want to spend the rest of your life in prison? I'll die tonight.
Sure. Right.
And, you know, a few minutes later, I ended up getting called. You know, I kind of got trapped in this like little warehouse complex where there was like nowhere to go, and I got called and went to jail. You know, and I admitted to everything. I mean, like I had a bank bag, not from a bank, but like a drop bag from a store that I'd robbed, and like it was obvious that, you know, I was up to no good, and the feds had a warrant for my arrest and all this stuff. I think I left that part out. The feds raided my apartment the day after I escaped from the sheriff, and you know, my girlfriend found out about everything. So that kind of fucked that relationship up a little bit.
threw that one for a loop. Yeah. Gotcha. Yeah.
So I wind up in, you know, I confessed everything. And part of the reason I did it is because I didn't want the girl that I was with to get like blamed for anything. So I just like, look, man, she has nothing to do with this. She's just a girl I'm hanging out with. Like, I'll tell you everything I did, but you gotta cut her loose.
Right. Right.
And so they agreed. And I admitted to like, I think it was like 23 or 28 robberies in Baltimore City, Baltimore County, Harford County, Carroll County, and a bunch of cars and all this other stuff. And, you know, so I'm sitting in the county jail and, you know, I've got, you know, I'm looking at literally like hundreds of years. And I thought, all right, well, I'm not done. You know, I'll get out of here. I'll figure out a way to get out. And I attempted to escape from that jail. And I mean, like, I missed it by that much, you know, thank God. But I managed to break a piece of steel off of one of the bunk beds, which was about 4 feet long, thick. And in my cell, they have this really heavy duty mesh security screen. I pried that whole frame off and all that. And then there was this heavy duty, like cast iron, like mesh behind that attached to the window. And then I kept prying at that, and I got a hole in it big enough for, you know, me and a couple of other people. Like, you could fit out of it as long as you didn't weigh like 300 pounds. Mm-hmm. And then I was using this piece of steel and prying out the plastic. It was plexiglass. Mm-hmm. Prying that out when they rolled in and called us. And I mean, it's like 3, 4, 5 minutes we'd have been out of there. And it wouldn't have just been me. I was on a high bail section. Like, everybody had $100,000 bailing up. I think my bail was like $600,000. Like, everybody... it would have been like 100 guys going through that window, 100 skinny guys going through the window.
So
the fat guys would still be in jail. But and they called us, and I went to, you know, so then I ended up getting put on lockup for 6 months, which means like you're locked in a cell by yourself, you know, 23 hours a day. You get out an hour to go take a shower and just walk around the tier.
Can't imagine. Yeah.
And that was really good for me that it worked out like that, because then the thing that happened that began the change for me was I went and my attorney came in, and my parents stepped up, got me an attorney, and he came in to see me, and we're sitting in this little conference room. There's like a metal table between us, and I'll never forget it. I mean, cause he really made me feel stupid. He looked at me and he said, "Man, what the fuck is wrong with you? Like, can't you even stay out of trouble in jail? Like, you're already locked up." Mm-hmm. And then he said, "Don't you realize that if you do what you're supposed to do, you can be home by the time you're 30 years old. You'll be young enough to start a whole new life." Mm-hmm. And I hadn't considered that.
You hadn't thought about it like that before.
Be home in 5 years, start a whole new life. Like, really? Like, is that an option?
Huh.
And I mean, I didn't say that to him at the time, but over the next course of the next couple of days, I really thought about that. And I thought, okay, I'm going to give this shit a try. And part of the thing that really made a difference was my friend Barb, who was with me when I got locked up.
Yeah.
She had managed to get like a few weeks clean, like maybe a month clean after we got locked up. She started hanging out with the first guy I ever shot coke with that went to a drug rehab. And he had like, I don't know, 2 or 3 months clean. And now she's hanging out with him and she's getting her stuff together. And nobody had done that. Like, I didn't know anybody that ever got clean.
Right.
And so I'm seeing like, man, it's possible. Like, you can get off the drugs.
Yeah.
And I'd be young enough to start a whole new life. And that's where my mindset started to change.
Exactly. This is the critical piece. I mean, so many things I could, you know, we could talk about from here. I remember in the previous episode on the other, on Good Deeds, we talked about several different kind of pivoting moments or really critical moments in your life. And this was obviously one of them, if not the biggest.
It was huge. I mean, but then there's one other thing that happened. There was three pieces to it. The next thing that happened is after I got off lockup, like I had committed myself, like, I'm going to figure this out. Like, I don't know what I'm going to do. Drugs didn't work, or, you know, drugs obviously don't work. Rehabs don't work. Jail didn't work because I've been to prison before. Living in the streets doesn't work. Different churches doesn't work. Different girlfriends in different states doesn't work. I got to figure something out. I don't know what it is, but I got to figure something out. Mm-hmm. And then I found a book.
Oh, right.
It was called You Can If You Think You Can. And it was on the tier on the table. And I didn't like, I didn't know they had self-help books. Like, I don't know if it's a new industry or what, but I didn't know they had.
I think it's grown a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. And I looked at it and I was like, you can if you think you can. I was like, oh, I got plenty of fucking time.
Right.
I mean, I'm going to read it. I think I've already read every Stephen King book in the jail. So let me go ahead and read this thing. Mm-hmm. And halfway through that book, something clicked in my head. And I realized that I can take control of my life and become the person that I want to become, but I have to believe in myself. And up until that point, I didn't believe in myself because I was always focusing on my failures. And halfway through this book, I was smoking cigarettes back then. You could smoke in jail back then. And halfway through the book, I'm like, man, fuck this. I'm taking control of my life. I'm taking over. I'm going to run this shit. I'm going to run. Not the drugs, me. And I took my half pack of cigarettes out and I gave it to this guy, Frank Bertina. I said, Frank, I'm fucking done. I'm changing my life. And of course, you know, it's like, well, I heard that before, you know, he's thinking like,
but that's
what happened. And
no, that's really, I mean, that's, yeah, this mindset shift, it may not have happened in 1 minute. I mean, it was over time, but there were critical.
Well, there moments. Was a time. I gotta tell you, like through that book, there was a time, it was in an instant. Like I knew, like, it was like that. It wasn't like a dimmer switch, like slowly going on and off. It might've been a dimmer, like preparing or fertilizing my mind for this. Sure. But once I read that one thing,
it
convinced me, like, man, I got this. I got it. And you can imagine, like, I mean, this isn't just with like drug stuff. This is with everything in life. Like, you know, this, like, if two guys are going to get in a boxing ring.
Yeah.
And one guy is thinking in his head, like, fuck, man, this guy's going to kick my ass. I hope he doesn't hit me in the face, man. I hope he doesn't fuck my face up. Like, he already lost a fight. You're already done.
Right.
This, if the same guy goes in with the attitude, man, I'm going to kill this guy. I'm going to tear his face off. His mom ain't going to know who he is when I'm done. You still might get your ass kicked, but the chances of winning are significantly greater if you believe in yourself.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's the belief, it's the fuel.
That's really what I want this podcast, not just this episode, but this whole podcast to be about. It really is about the mental, the mindset piece. You know, real estate was your, and, you know, we're not going to go into the weeds on how you did all your real estate stuff, but that was your, you know, kind of asset class or strategy as far as how you were able to build wealth and that kind of thing, but kind of doesn't really matter. You know, if you didn't have the mindset piece down, real estate never would have happened.
The mindset's everything. Critical. I mean, and you don't have to start where I started. You know, I mean,
It still applies to people who haven't robbed 23 or 28, banks and cars. And
I got to tell you, man, this is one of the things that I did that anybody that's listening to this, you can do this. This isn't like magic or anything. Like, up until this point, and this is something that I did myself, up until this point, when I thought about who am I just thought of all my failures and losses and things that I fucked up and people that I lied to and people that I hurt. And that's what I use to define who I am, the kind of person I am. And then I decided I'm going to, you know, it sounds corny, but I'm going to flip the script, right? I'm going to look at this thing and I'm going to sit down and I'm going to write down all the good things that I've ever done that I can think of. It ain't going to be a long list. It's going to be a short list.
But that's what you're going to focus on.
That's what I'm going to focus on.
Right, right.
And that's what I did. And the first thing on the list was I quit smoking cigarettes. That was the first thing.
I mean, and this is, when I say this, it's going to sound so much less dramatic, you know, but I had a similar shift kind of, you know, just, I was going to work every day, had the 9-to-5 job with a long commute and that I didn't have a terrible life. I'm not saying that. Right. But I just kind of fell into the trap of kind of Groundhog Day and this is what life is kind of thing. And then I realized I started pointing to my strengths and the people in my life that, you know, that could help me and kind of just my focus changed. And so it became more about teamwork and growth and strengths and looking at the positive. And that for me was a critical piece. This was back in, you know, 2013, 2014, just to start really kind of ratcheting up the real estate and note investing and things like that. But again, not as dramatic of a story, but it was really important because I could have easily just gotten caught in, you know, ho-hum, woe is me, this is my life and that kind of thing. So the mindset piece is critical.
People don't have to apologize. Like, well, you know, I wasn't that bad. Like this isn't a competition. This isn't a race to the bottom.
Right.
You know,
right,
it's like,
right.
I regret all of that stuff. But sure. If it wasn't for that, I might not be here today. And I've tilted the scales where I think I've done more good than bad now.
Yeah.
And, but I just, there's some things I want to mention that are, that to me are, yeah. are important to help people to heal is, you know, like maybe 12 years ago or so, I looked up the cop that arrested me. I looked him up on Facebook and I found him.
Yeah.
And I sent him a message and said, hey, did you used to work in Eastern District, Baltimore City Police Department? And he didn't respond. And he's probably like, you know, uh-oh. And then I, you know, sent him another message a couple weeks later. And I said, listen, you arrested me September 8th, 1989 on Monument Street, the corner of Monument and Crescent. And you saved my life. And I just want you to know that I am truly sorry for all of the shit that I ever did. And that's not how I was raised. And that's not the kind of person I am. And I sincerely regret all of it. And I just want to thank you because you saved my life and I appreciate it. And not too long after that, I got a response from him. And we're friends today. I mean, we've met, we've talked, we, you know, I talked to him maybe 6 months ago, got his number on my phone and we're friends today. And
awesome. So was that difficult? I mean,
for me?
Yeah.
No, so not at all, man. No, because it's healing for me to express, you know, to tell people how I feel, like my remorse and regret.
Gotcha.
But on the different side, I called the attorney that like said that life changing mm-hmm. thing to me.
Yeah, he spoke truth into you is what he did.
And I haven't talked to him since 1990. Well, this is like really funny, but I called him. He's still practicing law. I mean, he's got to be 100 years old, right? And I found him in the phone book and I called his office and he got on the phone. You know, the lady's like, well, is he expecting a call from you? And I was like, well, probably not. Which case is this involving? I was like, well, you know, it's a case from like, you know, 1989.
Right.
And she put him on the phone and I just relayed the story to him. And I just told him how, you know, the comments that he made had changed my life. And this is where I'm at today. Like, you know, I have a great life. I'm a respected member, contributing member of society. I have an amazing son. Like, you know, it's like I've got good friends, like good people that I hang out with. And I just wanted him to know that might not have happened if he hadn't said what he had. Like, that was like just a huge impact, mm-hmm. made a huge impact for me. And I didn't know it at the time, but he told me that I was actually on speaker, like after I told him this, like his whole audience. Or his whole
office
staff this conversation, and he didn't say it, but it sounded to me like he was becoming emotional.
I can imagine
just hearing it.
Sure. I mean,
and I still do when I talk about it because it was such a life-changing thing that I'm so grateful for. But
I'm sure he has done well financially and all that, but I would guess a phone call like that would be, you know, more important than any of that stuff.
I'm sure when he sat down with his, you know, significant other for dinner that night.
Yeah.
He said something to the effect of, guess who called me today?
Right. That wasn't your everyday, your average Tuesday.
Yeah. But, you know, my point is, and I've done this with other people under other circumstances. Mm-hmm. It's never too late to call somebody up and apologize.
Mm-hmm.
Or to thank them for something. You know, if somebody did something meaningful in your life, you know, even if it was a boss at Burger King 20 years ago, and they said something that made a positive impact in your life, it's never too late to go find those people and let them know. You'll make their day. You will make their day when you do that.
Yeah.
And it makes my day. It happens to me sometimes where people call me up and, you know, tell me they heard this podcast and it like made a difference in their life. Like, man, that's what it's all about. I mean that's what else makes it worth it.
We sure could use a lot more of that given the last, just the general, you know, dynamic of how things are with social media and people tearing each other down. And, you know, there's too much of that going on. Keyboard warriors, you know, bashing people online mob. And so, yeah, I mean, I love it. That would be fantastic if we could get more of a movement like that. People,
we're probably, you know, are we running over?
We are running over a little bit. You know, we may end up, I don't know, maybe we'll break this into two episodes, but yeah, I mean, I've got a few more questions we can run through real fast.
I got plenty of time.
Yeah. I mean, so just to kind of finish up the, so you just the very short version of, you know, where'd you go when you, after you made that mindset shift, then you got into real estate and then you had all the, and you ended up quitting your job. I know there's a ton of detail in there, you know, that we're skipping over, but if you could just give the 30 seconds synopsis of what happened from the mindset shift to where you are today.
Sure. So that mindset shift happened. It was either April 20th or 22nd of 1990. I stayed in prison for another little over 4 years. I got locked up September 89. I got out in June of 94. So however many months that is, I think it's like 4 years and 9 months. Before I got out, I got a 2-year degree in business from a local junior community college. They actually have the instructors come to the prison, same book, same exams, everything's the same. It's just you're in prison. And I got a construction certificate where you're like learning how to frame houses and, you know, just all that stuff. And I just figured I got to do the time, but that doesn't mean I have to waste it. Like, sure. I'm going to make the best use of this time. So when I get out, I'm as best prepared as I can be to take on like a whole new life.
Yeah.
And right before I got out, I maybe 6 months before I got out, this is a really important lesson is I wrote a letter to my high school girlfriend that I had broken up with in high school. And I broke up with her because I knew where I was going. Like, I knew like I'm a loser and she's going to go to college and have a great life. And like, I can't change. And so I broke up with her, but I had always regretted breaking up with her. I mean, I was in love with her and she was just such an amazing woman. And so I wrote her like maybe 6 months before I got out and just, I've still remembered her address. I mean, like, this was before email and, you know, all that stuff. And I wrote her a letter and just told her how things turned out. And she wrote me back and said, you know, I'm doing great. Graduated school, got a great job, got an apartment, got a boyfriend. Don't ever write me again.
Oh, geez.
And actually she had broken up with her boyfriend. She didn't tell me that at the time in that letter. And so I got that response and I was just grateful that I got a response. You know, it kind of gave me some closure. Like, I was able to say the things I wanted to say.
Yeah.
And, but then I thought to myself, well, I didn't say everything. Like, I didn't really tell her the real stuff. Mm-hmm. And since she's not going to talk to me anymore and I don't blame her, let me just go ahead and tell her I want to go deep and just tell her why I did what I did and how I felt about it. And I'll probably never talk to her again, but at least I have this off my conscience. Like, this is off my plate. And so I wrote her, you know, it took a few days to get the letter just right. And then dropped it in the mail. A couple of weeks later, I got a response. Well, you know, we can talk, we can write. And then a month or two later, she was coming up to see me. And then a few months later, I got out of jail. And a couple months later, we're living together. And a couple years later, we got married.
we're still together. She's a traveling nurse.
Yeah. And so the point of that story is like, man, if somebody says like, no, you just gotta find a different way to ask the question.
Well, I think, you've shown that you've been resourceful your entire life. I mean, you always figured out a way to make it happen, but the big thing was you were maybe going down in the kind of negative dark path before, and you've changed your direction.
I think that you develop a lot of skills when you head in that direction, like a lot of life saving skills.
Right.
I mean, just as an example, when I got to Florida, hitchhiked to Jacksonville. And so I got nothing. I got no money, nowhere to go, no food. And I'm thinking, well, I got to get a job. But if I get a job, then I'm not going to get paid for a couple of weeks. And I can't go to the shelters and the missions to get lunch and stuff like that because I'm at work.
Because you have right. Yep. Sure.
So I can't go 2 weeks without eating. And I can't go in a grocery store every night and steal food, which is another thing I used to do. I would just grab food and go and sneak it in the bathroom and eat it right in the grocery store. And, I mean, that includes like raw hot dogs and cheese. Like, it doesn't matter. You know, it's like when you're hungry, it doesn't matter if it's a raw hot dog. And so then I got this thought, it's like, okay, I'm not going to get paid for 2 weeks, but I need to eat. What if I get a job in a place that sells food? Then I can eat at work. So that's what I did. Right. I got a job working at a hot dog stand.
There's and always a way.
Yeah. And it's just like, so a lot of times people, like my wife does this all the time. She just sees obstacles. Oh, you can't do this. I'm just like, oh, wait a minute, hold up. You know, I'll find a way around this. And that's my skill is figuring out I'll either go over it, around it, behind it, under it, blow it up. Like I'm, or I'll go all the long way around, whatever it is, there's a way. And just, I suggest to people, like, never give up, man. I don't care if you're trying to lose weight and you keep falling off the thing, you're trying to quit drinking, you're trying to quit smoking, and you just keep, you know, failing. Like, don't stop, man. Just don't stop. And you know, don't give up. You're worth so much more. You were worth so much more. And people don't realize how much their failures, how they can turn that into something where they can help so many people with their stories, you know, because they're not the only ones that fail. We all fail. I still fail at stuff, but you can take those failures and turn them into strengths and make a difference in people's lives.
I mean, that's from adversity to abundance. That's the name of the podcast. Right. And that's
right. Exactly.
It really is. I mean, you know, that's the whole point of this show, is, you know, you may not see it at the time when you're going through the struggles, and I'm not suggesting you necessarily choose to go through struggles.
I wouldn't suggest that you do it on purpose.
But you can use those, you know, in a way that maybe other people can't. I mean, because you've been through that, you've developed these strengths and these personality traits and things. You know, you can use that experience to now help others. So as we move toward the end of the show here, these are going to be kind of a lightning round, quick questions. Okay.
Bring it on.
What is a book or two that you'd recommend to my audience and why?
I would say, assuming that they are not starting where I started, Rich Dad, Poor Dad.
Nice. Love it.
Probably number one. If you're like a business oriented entrepreneurial kind of person, because that is going to just expose a lot of the BS that we've been brainwashed with since birth in this country. Sure.
That's so, a good one.
That's probably probably the main one. I could probably name five others, but that's the main one.
Got it. How about a movie? I don't know if you watch movies or anything. Any good movies?
Oh man, you know.
How about this? A movie or a podcast? You pick one.
One of my favorite movies, it's a fiction movie. It was called Starman with Jeff Bridges.
Okay.
And it's a tearjerker. When people ask me what my favorite movie is, that's always one that pops up
in my mind. Right.
The worst one was Jaws. So
the worst one was Jaws.
Yeah, man. Yeah.
I never got into that one. What's one question you wish I'd asked you, but I haven't asked.
Oh man. you know, there's nothing really. I mean, I wish I could give you like a real smart, you know, clever answer, but I'm open, man.
Love it. We've covered so much ground, and I really do feel like that you've got so much to unpack with your story. It's incredible. There's no way we could cover it all in one episode here, and then we've already touched on this somewhat, but how do you like to serve others? How are you adding value to others these days?
One way is like this, like doing this. I mean, I don't get paid for this. You know, this is my most valuable asset is time.
Sure.
You know, it's a limited resource.
Yeah.
But if I can spend my time doing something like this, where I might potentially reach, you know, maybe hundreds or thousands of people that I will never meet, and it can have a positive effect on their lives.
Yeah.
Like that's a gift I'm able to actually do that as a gift for me. It's kind of selfish because it makes me feel good to be able to help other people. That's probably the main way is by talking. I mean, I give money to charities and stuff like that, but that's like,
sure.
I think time is more valuable than the money. And
I agree.
So I would say that that's what I do, is I just try to influence people and inspire people to live their best lives.
I love it. Now that goes into the next, the final question here. Where can our listeners find you online? Because I know you do have, you know, YouTube channel and some other things going on. What do you have going on, and where can people reach out to you?
Okay. So I've got a YouTube channel. Best thing to do would be to just email me directly, mark@markowens.com. And ask me if you're looking for my YouTube channel, I'll send you a link, because I can't even remember the name of it. I've got a Facebook group for real estate investors. There's a page in a group. Just if you do a search, it's Mark Owens, REI. And just the group is there. I think there's like 1,000 people in it. The page is just like a placeholder. So don't waste your time with that. But email is probably the best way. And then if you tell me what you're looking for, whether it's YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, whatever.
Yeah,
I can just answer you directly.
Perfect. Now, are you going to be in Charleston for a foreseeable future?
I'm going to be in Charleston for my wife's contract is, she starts another one. It's in April, May, and June. I'm staying till the beginning of June. Then I'm heading out to Leadville, Colorado for a month.
Nice.
To train at elevation, because I'm going to be going to King's Peak, which is the highest mountain in Utah. Bora, which is the highest mountain in Idaho. I've got a permit to climb Whitney, which is the highest mountain in the lower 48 states, which is in California. And I'm going to do Boundary Peak in Nevada. So I'm going to do the highest point in four different states in July. That's awesome. So nice. That's my plans for July.
That's so cool. All right. Well, there's so much more we could dive into, but we'll have to save that for, if we can get you back on another time. This has been really, really good, Mark. I mean, I just love this. I just love your, you know, I hate that you had to go through all that. I mean, obviously, like you said, some of that was maybe your own doing, but
it was all my own doing, man. That's the only way that you can change your life is if you accept 100% responsibility for what you do. I never blamed anybody else. I made the choices.
I mean, it's, you know, I know you say you don't want to compare, but that's some serious adversity that you overcame and that you went through. And now, I mean, you know, it definitely seems from my perspective, you're living an abundant life. I'm sure you have struggles like everybody else, right? But you've got free time, and it sounds like you've got financial freedom from your real estate and other endeavors. So, I mean, definitely come a long way, and I really feel like this is going to inspire a lot of people. So I really just want to thank you for coming on, Mark, and spending your most valuable resource with us, which is your time. So thanks a lot.
Hey, thank you, Jamie. Thank you for having me. Be happy to come back anytime in the future if you want to continue the discussion.
Sounds great. And to our listeners out there, please go out and rate and review our show. We'd love it. We're in a growth phase, obviously. So we appreciate you listening. Take care, everyone.
Thank you for joining us on From Adversity to Abundance. We hope today's episode has equipped you with valuable insights and practical advice to elevate your real estate journey. For more inspiring stories and resources, visit us at www.adversitytoabundance.com. If this episode has inspired you, please share it with a friend who could also benefit from our conversation. Together, let's turn adversity into abundance. Until next time, keep building your mental fitness and your real estate empire.
All right, here's the deal. You work hard for your money. Isn't it about time you put your money to work for you? If you are an accredited investor, check out LabradorLending.com. Our Integrity Income Fund provides monthly cash flow from an investment backed by hard physical real estate. Our income fund, which is uncorrelated to publicly traded stocks and bonds, invests in first lien mortgage notes diversified by geography, property value, and borrower type. So you're not investing in one project. You're investing in a diversified portfolio of first lien mortgage notes. Our Integrity Income Fund aims to pay its investors monthly distributions at a preferred rate of return of 8% annually. Possibly the best part, though, the fund showcases a short 12-month commitment. So you can invest your capital today and have access to that capital in 1 year. Check it out today, LabradorLending.com.